Everything functions because of us. And I said that we are no longer apologetic about taking that kind of a position. There is no question about it that there's something about us that the nations of the world don't understand, but everything seems to revolve around us. The world, in fact, holds us to a completely different standard than they hold themselves. And they don't even feel guilty about being a pack of hypocrites. I was just reading the Jerusalem Post this morning. There was a general, Michael Freund's article this morning about, was it Michael Freund? Yeah, about General Powell, who went into, the American government sent him into Panama, and he blew up nearly 3,000 homes. 13,000 people had to flee from their homes. Who knows how many were killed? And he's lecturing us yesterday about what we're doing in Gaza. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And they do it without batting an eyelash, you understand. We are held to a completely different standard than the rest of the world. And I think that there are times at which we have to be precisely like the rest of the world. Anyway, so after the Kuzriya talked about the fact that we have kalev, like the heart, amongst the organs of the body, and then he went on to talk about the fact that even though it would seem as though we are dead, dry bones, and then we started singing, but them bones shall rise again, because them bones, the dry bones of the Jewish people, once had the divine spirit, and they still do have the divine spirit. From there we went on. Last week we talked about the fact that there is a hierarchy in nature, and I told you again not to be apologetic about it all. There's the inanimate object, the domain, the stone, the rock, earth. Above it comes that which grows, the tzomeach, that which grows. After that comes chai, that which lives, the animal kingdom. And then comes medaber, the one who speaks, that is man. And Rav Yehuda Halevi adds a fifth, and that is Yisrael, stands higher than the rest of the world. Which brought him to the discussion of what is a pious individual. And he wanted to make it very clear to him, as he had told him earlier, that what is considered pious by the nations of the world is something that God never, ever required of us. Which means the ascetic, the one who's the hermit, the one who hides away in solitude and prays day and night, the one who denies himself some of the most basic needs of the human being. This kind of conduct is what is seen in the non-Jewish world, as being great piety, great holiness. So he says, I told you already, don't you know that Torah did not require of us to live in pain or in suffering? In part three, he's going to begin to describe the classic chassid. Now, when he says the word chassid over here, don't in any way assume that it means what the word chassid has come to mean in our time, a member of a chassidic sect who has a rebbe. A chassid in classical biblical Hebrew, a chassid is a pious, a truly religious individual. A religious individual. As the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Lo am ha'oretz chassid. An ignoramus cannot be a chassid because he doesn't know what are the basic requirements of Judaism. The chassid maybe can also be interpreted as the one, not only is pious, or maybe that's even its definition. His piety extends to the point where he attempts his life lifnim mishurat hadin, in a sense, beyond the requirements of the law. Not everything has to be the law. we don't necessarily, and I think most of us, we don't necessarily live like, you know, if this is the Lord, that's it, and I'm not going to go one step further. We're charitable, we're concerned people, we have a sense of compassion. All of these make up the what we'd say is the psychology of the chassid. So he's going to try and explain what a chassid is. And remember, we're talking about a fine, observant Jew. And I don't care whether you want to call him modern Orthodox or you want to call him old Orthodox. He can be a Lita'i, he can be a chassid in quotation marks. We're talking about, you know, maybe the best best description is a good Jew. A guter Yidah Mensch. That's what he's going to describe. How does he live his life? What's important to him? What does he seek out of life? This is going to be quite a description, and it's not going to be done very quickly. But let's see. And I have to have my Hebrew and my English. In the English, it's on page 135. And at the very outset, you already see what he has in mind. According to our view, a servant of God is not one who detaches himself from the world, lest he be a burden to it, and it to him. One who detaches himself from life, he's going to describe later, is somebody who will ultimately begin to hate life, because of the kind of restrictions that he has placed upon himself. A human being is a social animal. He needs other people. He has to be in the company of other people. It's absolutely unnatural for him to sort of retire from civilization and go off into a cave someplace and pray unto the Lord all day. So according to our view, a servant of God is not one who detaches himself from the world, lest he be a burden to it and it to him, or hates life. He's not one who hates life, which is one of God's bounties granted him. He says, we look at life as a great blessing. Life is a blessing. And if life is a blessing, life has to be lived to the fullest. Within, of course, the confines, or I would better say, the enhancement of halacha. Whatever restrictions it is, I like that word, by the way. Whatever restrictions that are placed upon our conduct by halacha, the ultimate goal and objective of it is that man doesn't act like an animal, and therefore it enhances the quality of his life. If life is a blessing, then we have to use that blessing. As it is written, the number of thy days I will fulfill, and thou shalt live long. Arichus yomim. Length of life is something that we see as a great blessing. Now, if life is all drudgery and being alone, separate from everybody else, that's not a happy life. Yes?
How come Rabbi Gold that the Torah comes into the Nazirus?
The Nazir, so it's very, first of all, I have to tell you, Tov Meod, that you asked, because it's going to be next week's Sedra, not this coming week's Sedra. Next week's Sedra is going to be Parshat Naso, and it's going to talk about the Nazir, the one who takes a vow, and by the way, let's remember one thing. The Nazir's vow does not remove him from society. It prohibits him from drinking or eating anything that comes from the vine or the grape. He has to let his hair grow, and he's not permitted to allow himself to be defiled by contact with a dead body. So number one, the Nazir that the Torah speaks of is in no way similar to what was known as nezirut, so to speak, by the nations of the world. He's not a hermit. He's not somebody who's living alone. He's not somebody who's outside of the camp. The nazir can live within the community just like anybody else. The only person who's isolated is the metzora. And his isolation is a temporary one. And his isolation is for the express purpose that he should do tshuva so that he should be healed and be able to rejoin society. God wants people in society. The Gemara says it, the Rambam paskens it. Ha-poresh midarkei tzibur, one who separates himself from the community, will never be able to do tshuva. You can't separate yourself. You can't go off on your own. You're part of a people. You're part of a people. You're part of a family. You're part of a society. I wanted to tell you something else about the Nazir. What else I wanted to tell you about the Nazir is, even though the restrictions on the Nazir that he places upon himself are not that great, there are two opinions in the Gemara. One opinion in the Gemara is Nazir Chotehu. A Nazir is a sinner. Why is he a sinner? Who gave you the right to prohibit upon yourself something that God permitted to you? Even more than that, there is a Talmud Yerushalmi that says that a person is going to be called to judgment and asked why there are certain things in this world that he did not enjoy or benefit from. There are things in this world that God wants us to enjoy. I'm not sure what he has in mind. I'm trying to find out. I don't know yet. I don't know yet. Yes. He can't make a book. I can think of worse aveiros, but all right, okay. But the Nazir is certainly in no way, shape, or form similar to the monk in a monk or a nun or. Of course, he's allowed to marry, and usually nazirut was something of a temporary nature. The Gemara says, "Stam nazirut." If a person says, "Hareni nazar," I should be a nazir. It's for a period of 30 days, and despite that, there's a difference of opinion. One opinion of the Gemara says that nazir is a sinner. And then another opinion says, Nazir is kadosh, Nazir is holy. And in a sense, why? Because in Parashat Naso, next week, it's going to be juxtaposed with the Parsha of the woman who may have been unfaithful to her husband. There are times at which a person has to realize that he has experienced certain things that maybe the best thing is for a little period of time to withdraw. Kol haroes sota bikilkula, one who sees the woman who is a sota as she is punished, yazir atzmo min hayayin, should remove himself from wine. But there's no such thing. Every Jew is part of a community, and we have to remain part of that community. On the contrary, he loves the world. He's describing, I don't know why he used, Oved ha'eloka shalanu, the servant of God. That's a good, I don't even like servant of God. An observant Jew is one who loves the world, and he loves long life, because it affords him opportunities of deserving the world to come. You can do mitzvahs, you can do more mitzvahs. The more good he does, the greater is his claim to the next world. He even reaches the degree of enoch, really, that's Chanoch, concerning whom it is said he's going to say that there is the rare instance where a person reaches a peak of such kind of sanctity that he has really achieved all that man could conceivably be achieve in this world, and then God will take him from the world. And he's not going to feel bad about it, because on the contrary, he may very well want to be part of the community of angels above. But those are rare individuals. That's not for us. That's not for us. He even reaches the degree of Chanoch concerning whom it is said, and Chanoch walked with God, or the degree of Eliyahu, freed from worldly matters and to be admitted to the realm of angels. Those are the rarities, the only two that he can mention in all of Tanakh. Eliyahu was taken up to heaven. In this case, if he has indeed reached that level, he feels no loneliness and solitude and seclusion, since they form his associates. He wants to be in isolation and solitude. He is rather ill at ease in a crowd. On the contrary, that kind of a pious, angel-like individual is ill at ease in a crowd because he misses the divine presence which enables him to dispense with eating and drinking. Such persons might perhaps be happier in complete solitude. They might even welcome death because it leads to the step beyond which there is none higher. He also puts into this category, in this very unique category, one that we are not to follow. He wants to get these out of the way, that Torah does not want us to follow. There are the philosophers and scholars also love solitude to refine their thoughts. Now, when he's talking about philosophers and scholars, he's not talking about garden variety philosophers and so-called scholars that you find in any kind of university around here. He's talking about a Socrates and a Plato. There were a few people since the dawn of civilization that were so scholarly that their minds were so brilliant that they really lived in a world of all of their own. He's not talking about anybody who considers themselves a scholar. We're not talking about garden variety philosophers. Philosophers and scholars also love solitude to refine their thoughts and to reap the fruits of truth from their researches in order that all remaining doubts be dispelled by truth. They only desire, and for that matter they need the society of disciples who stimulate their research and retentiveness, just as he was bent upon making money would only surround himself with persons with whom he could do lucrative business. A businessman doesn't have any time to waste. Time is money, you understand? He has nothing to talk with me about. For me, he's not going to make any money. But he'll certainly enjoy the company of people who are also in the wheeler-dealer world of investment and all of that. Such a degree is that of Socrates and those who are like him. There is no one nowadays who feels tempted to strive for such a degree. So he says, let's forget about it. There's nobody today that is in that category. But when the divine presence was still in the Holy Land among the people capable of prophecy, some few persons lived an ascetic life in deserts and associated with people of the same frame of mind. What he is referring to in Tanakh, they talk about the B'nai HaNeviim. They're called the sons of the prophets. They were really the students of the prophets. And there were schools of students of prophets that met in the forest. I mean, so he's still describing a very small group of people throughout all of history that had reached a certain peak for whom the ascetic life of solitude was good. And they did not seclude themselves completely, but they endeavored to find support in the knowledge of the law and in holy and pure actions which brought them near to that high mark. They also needed company. But they needed the kind of company, the kind of associates that were going to assist them to grow in their piety. These were the disciples of the prophets. He, however, in our time, place, and people, whilst no open vision exists, it means there is no prophecy anymore. We're just plain human beings. The desire for study being small, and persons with a natural talent for it are absent. We're talking about the talent for prophecy and seclusion and solitude and hermitude. And would like to retire into ascetic solitude only courts distress and sickness for soul and body. He's going to destroy himself in any attempt to sort of mimic the holy people of yesteryear what he's really going to do is destroy his own life. The misery of sickness is visibly upon him. You know, he says you might look at him and see this ascetic, this humble, holy man. He looks, his face is drawn, he's ausgeweicht and ausgedarrt, and he's white, and you think, you might think, well, this is his piety. So you know what? He says, don't make the mistake of thinking it's his piety. He simply has made himself sick of life. He's sick of it all. He pietized himself into a corner. That's what he did. Like what's he going to do now? He's going to come out of solitude and say, okay, boys, now we're going to live life to the fullest. He can't do it anymore. The misery of sickness is visibly upon him, but one might regard it as the consequence of humility and contrition. Don't make any mistake, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says. Don't be fooled by it. If he looks like heck, it's because he feels like heck. He considers himself in prison, as it were, and despairs of life from disgust of his prison and pain, but not because he enjoys his seclusion. Make no mistake. If he is really one who secludes himself, then you should know, as we talked last week toward the end of this year, if they look good and healthy and ruddy and they're Catholic priests, then you had better suspect that their seclusion is not so secluded and their isolation is not so isolated. Yes? I would imagine that if one feels that they can have some kind of influence on a person of this sort, it's a tremendous chesed, just like it's an act of kindness. It's an act of kindness to give somebody something to eat or to assist them. This person needs assistance too. The only thing is, the question is, this person, he may need the kind of assistance you're not able to give. At times it may very well be, certainly today, it may very well be that he needs psychological or psychiatric assistance. So if you can get somebody to somebody who can help them. Your son-in-law is a psychiatrist? As Feltem business? No, it's Feltem. Okay, that's what I thought. By the way, I can always use it. People need help. I recall that, when you're a young rabbi and you go into the field, first of all, you're thrilled about the fact that the members of your congregation look at you like you're God. And sometimes you even begin to think you're as much God as a doctor. They are God, you understand. So you think that you can resolve all problems, and then you have to grow up and begin to find out that maybe the best thing you can do is to send people, refer people in the right direction. Send them, get them to go for help. And there's so much help available today for so many different kinds of problems. There are so many people that would they have had some kind of psychological or counseling help at some point in life, it would have made their lives a great deal happier. And that's an act of chesed. So I would not put it as kiruv. Kiruv sounds like it's frummy wummy. No, I'm talking... I think yes. If you know that a fellow human being is in pain, or a fellow human being is doing something, I'll take you one step further. He's going to say later that this person is going to be so disgusted with life, he's going to reach a point where he's going to drop it all. this fellow may end up being a Mechalel Shabbos and a Leichel Treifus from having been the great and pious person before. He needs help. He needs help, and it falls into the category of hocheach tocheach, to lead a person onto the correct path. That's as much an act of kindness as any other kind of kindness. So he says that this fellow is ultimately going to reach a point where he feels disgust and pain with life. And how could it be otherwise? He has no intercourse with the divine light. In other words, he's not somebody whom God shines down upon so that he is sated with his relationship with God. And he cannot associate himself with it as the prophets did. He lacks the necessary learning to be absorbed in it and to enjoy it, as the philosophers did all the rest of his life. Suppose he is God-fearing, righteous, desires to meet his God in solitude, standing humbly and contritely, reciting as many prayers and supplications as he possibly can remember. All this affords him, this is very important. What he says now is very important. There may be a person who wants to talk and be involved in prayer and tilim and all sorts of holy things. He says, it all this affords him satisfaction for a few days, as long as it is new. And he's even going to talk about the... And this, you have to understand, is very fascinating. It's become the in thing over the years of writing our own prayers. And there are even those who've written over the years. I never had to suffer through a few weddings where the chosen and kala composed their own vows, you understand, and each one speaking to the other. Vezel, the Ebishter Abbeten. I don't think any of those marriages... survive. We couldn't. How can you survive all that garbage that they're saying to one another over there? I've seen it already. I've seen enough of it. Never. And you know what? There's one thing that never loses the ability to move you, and that's a Shmona Esrei that was written by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. It has a sense of eternity to it. At any moment of day or night, you want to daven. And you say a Shemana, you're going to find in that Shemana, I said today, Avil Yerushalayim Ircha Berachamim Toshuv, with such kavana, I tell you, that the heavens didn't open up. I'm wondering why the heavens didn't open up. Maybe they're waiting for Mincha. I don't know, for Mincha, yes, of course. All right. And it's true about, what he's saying over here is true about so many things. 25 years ago, when women started being freed, Betty Friedan was freeing them, the Emancipation Proclamation. So I remember in one sermon I said, you know, we have to wait a generation and see how this is going to affect the children of the next generation. I'm not so sure that it's such a great idea. So, of course, the women's libbers in shul wrote me, you know, they just wrote me off like, this guy's a frumach in here. And then, I don't know, I was away and I come back and I see there's a Time magazine in the house about women unashamedly, no, we want to stay home, we want to have children, and we want to stay home with the children. That's the in thing now. Now, you know, if we would simply remove the 25 years, the last 25 years, and who knows how many women fell prey to it all and may now regret it. They should have stayed home with the children. They should have spent more time with their children in the formative years. Was becoming or having gotten married? Yes, to have the children. Well, there are other ways to do it, okay? All right. Now, there are new ideas, and people are caught up in the excitement of what's a new idea. And if you express something that's not in favor of this new idea, then you're just old hat. But if you wait around long enough, and you're not a human, you understand, so you ride it out. Now I'm in. What I said 25 years ago is back in again now. And probably if I have my ties from 25 years ago, they'd also be in style right now. So he says the new can be very exciting, but you know what? It lasts only a few days. What he means is it's brief, it's ephemeral, it's passing, it's absolutely passing. It just doesn't have the seeds of eternity in it. Words frequently repeated by the tongue lose their influence on the soul, and he cannot give to the latter humbleness or submission. You reach a point where all of these things that excited you don't excite you anymore. Thus he remains. So this poor ascetic, the fellow who has gone off into the hills to be alone with God, he remains night and day whilst his soul urges him to employ its innate powers in sin. In other words, God made us that we have all sorts of organs in the body, and we have all sorts of abilities, and you know what they were for? So we should use them. And you know what he really yearns for? He really yearns to use his innate powers of seeing, hearing, speaking, occupation, eating, cohabitation, gain, managing his house, here, going to work, helping the poor, upholding the law, with money in case of need. There are natural things that people have to do. I pity people who, for whatever reason it is, don't have to work. It's a curse not to have to work. I mean, there are the rare individuals who are such great scholars that are going to sit and learn Torah, Yom Valayla, and even there, I don't think it's good for them. Person has to be able to express himself. Person has to be out there doing something. You have to enter into a relationship with people. You have to take the Torah, whatever it is that you studied, and impart it. And huh? The chayv, absolutely. That's the thing. There's so many things. I know a number of people that pashut their parents have enough money to take care of them for all generations. We think. And I look at them like they're pitiful. They're mamish. They're pathetic. They're pathetic. And they don't realize it yet. They don't understand that a person has to have a sense of accomplishment. You have to be able to do something. You have to get out there. Everybody wants the feeling of having done something and that it's even appreciated by people. And you can see an impact that you have on people. This is the heady kind of stuff from which life is made. Yes. I can't hear. Granted, that's fine. But everything has to be balanced. In other words, anything too extreme is not good. In other words, there are certainly women who their neshama, it compels them to get out of the house. They have to do things. And then there are, of course, those who are perfectly happy to stay home and have children and take care of the children. All that I'm saying is there's nothing wrong with having children and working, as long as everything is done to in a sense of moderation. It can't be to the extreme. Any extreme is bad. I'm not against women working. But I did once tell my women there in West Hempstead, if you want to work, then whatever happens, I'll watch you running to the Long Island Railroad in the morning, sleepy-eyed, maybe carrying your cup of coffee just like the men. And I'm going to watch you when you come schlepping back 7, 8 o'clock at night, or you're going to make sure to know you're gevaked like the men. You understand? And you will deserve everything that you are. You thought that this is the great freedom. It's not necessarily freedom. I'm not opposed to women working. By the way, you know what? What I am opposed to, I'll tell you what I'm opposed to. Women not being paid just like men. When a woman is paid less because she's a woman, that's unjust and that's unfair. And that happens in a lot of cases. It happens in a lot of cases. I'm going in order. Yes. I didn't really want to start up with them because it's not really them, even though those members of our mishpacha that I was thinking about, or sort of, you know, extended family, I really pity them. I really pity them. It's very pathetic that they think that, you know, they're living on top of the world, but they're going to have to find some kind of an outlet. Listen, Reb Moshe Feinstein didn't sit one day in kol. He was working. He was already working when he got married. His first job, I think he was 24 years old. He became rabbi in Luban, and he married the Shamus's daughter. 3 years later, he was 27 years old. He married the Shamus's daughter. An exceptional woman. So what if she was a Shamus's daughter? So what? No, I'm just saying. By the way, you know, I don't want to end up being like, you know, like I'm attacking everybody. I'm not attacking. I think that there is a problem there. There is a serious problem there. I see a lot of young people floating around who are trying to make a living by doing odd jobs. They could have gone to school, become a fine a lawyer, a good accountant, maybe even a heart surgeon, and wait, we got to go in. Got to go in order. We've given you. Go ahead. Even though B'zeyat Apecha Toch Alechem was said to Adam, B'zeyat Apecha Toch Alechem, by the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread, that was said to Adam Arishon. To her it was said that she will give birth with difficulty. So listen, I just want you to know, I'm not in a negative mood today. I'm on everybody's side. I'm on everybody's side. Women who feel they have to work should work, but it has to be with a... with Seichel, exactly. It has to be with Seichel. It has to be with Seichel. Yes. Yeah, well, I don't want to come across as being so negative. I'm not so negative. Like, some of my best friends, my children sat and learned for a number of years, but each one went out. My sons-in-law sat and learned for a number of years, but each one went out to work afterwards in respective fields. You can't. I don't know. Anyway, all right. Must he not regret those things to which he has tied his soul, or regret which tends to remove him from the divine influence which he desired to approach? That's the ultimate sentence. The result of his going out over there to be in solitude and see God is going to produce a result that's going to be precisely the opposite of what he wanted to accomplish. Because you know what? He's going to regret and get sick of this being under the regimen that he's accepting, and therefore he's never going to be able to approach the idea of divinity or being close to God. Now that we've gone through the negative, now is going to come the positive. So what is a servant of God? And what's a good Jew? What is a good Jew? So the king says, give me a description of the doings of one of your pious men at the present time. And remember, don't think pious men is anybody different than anybody sitting in this room. You know, what's a good Tayyid supposed to do? And therefore, he's now going to tell him an answer that's going to shake up the king. The king doesn't even understand what the man is talking to him. A pious man is, so to speak, the guardian of his country, who gives to its inhabitants provisions and all they need. He is so just that he wrongs no one, nor does he grant anyone more than is due. Then when he requires them, he finds them obedient to his call. He orders, they execute. He forbids, they abstain. The king gets a little... I asked you about a pious person. I didn't ask you to describe a king or a leader of men to me. I asked thee concerning a pious man, not a prince. And you're telling me about a man who takes care of all of his inhabitants and is concerned about them, so that when the time comes and he calls upon them, they will heed. The rabbi, the pious man is nothing but a prince who is obeyed by his senses and by his mental as well as his physical faculties, which he governs corporeally, as it is written, he that ruleth his spirit is better than he that taketh a city. Moshel B'Yitzro, let me get that, it's a pasuk in Mishlei. So I forgot, you know, I feel bad when I forget a pasuk. I feel bad when I... Moshel B'Rucho Milokeid Ir. Moshel B'Rucho, the one who rules over his spirit, is greater than one who captures and conquers a city. What he's going to describe is the following. There are so many faculties and so many abilities and so many parts that make up the human being. The pious man is the one who trains them all. But you know how he trains them all? First, he gives every part of his body what it requires and what it needs. Doesn't deny them anything that is necessary. If he doesn't deny them anything that is necessary, and he watches them and is concerned about them, when the moment comes that he's going to need all of those faculties or some of them, they are going to be ready to heed. So he has used the metaphor of a king, a ruler, a prince over his population is the mind and the intellect of a pious, gute, frumme yid. And therefore he says, Moshel Berucho, the one who rules over spirit, is greater than Locadia. He is fit to rule, because if he were the prince of a country, he would be just, he would be as just as he is to his body and soul. As he takes care of himself, so he will look out for the needs of the people of his community. He subdues his passions, keeping them in bonds, but giving them their share in order to satisfy them as regards food, drink, cleanliness, etc. All of the functions of the body, he takes care of them all. He further subdues the desire for power, but allows them as much expansion as avails them for the discussion of scientific or mundane views and other. If he has a desire for power, you know how he's going to channel it? We all have certain desires. You have to find out how to sublimate it. He says, you know where he'll sublimate power? By his ability to debate and finally prevail in a contest of wills or intellect. You don't have to subdue anybody. You can subdue ideas, as well as to warn the evil-minded. Power can also be used in the fulfillment of a mitzvah. Hochreach tochiach et amitecha. Be the one who warns your fellow man. He allows the senses their share according as he requires them for the use of hands, feet, and tongue as necessity or desire arise. I even understand in the words of the of Rav Yudah Halevi that he makes sure that all of the parts of his body are functioning the way they should. You need a walk, what do they say? Walking is the best exercise. You have to take care of your body. You have to take care of your body. If I ever have complaints to my yeshiva, years ago, they should have made sure that we really had phys ed. Phys ed shouldn't have been just something that, you got a got credit for it. But they should have had us do exercise. They should have had us do exercise. And then we have to start doing it already when we've passed a certain peak in life, it becomes more difficult. But it's clear that exercise is terribly, terribly important. Terribly important. All of the organs of the body, they're things that they require. And the pious person, the Oved Hashem, is the one that makes sure that all of the organs of the body have what they require. Torah never, ever asked of a human being to withdraw, in a sense, from this world. The most that the Torah did was ask for a fast day. One day in the year, as far as Torah is concerned, there's only one fast day. That's Yom Kippur. That's it. Otherwise, no. The same is the case with hearing, seeing, and the kindred associations which succeed them. Imagination. You have to use your imagination, conception, thought, memory, and willpower, which commands all these. But it is in its turn subservient to the will of the intellect. In other words, I have to be able to train. My mind has to be able to train my thought and my imagination. I can't let my imagination go wild. There are times at which my intellect has to say, no. You're going to think about these things and you're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble. No, man, like a prince or a ruler, has to be able to rule himself. And in proper ruling requires not only to rule, but it also requires you have a country, you have to make sure that people have the food that's necessary, the sanitary facilities, there's so much that they need. Where don't you find this? In totalitarian and dictatorial societies. What happens to what? You take a look at the Palestinians are a prime example. Prime example. Those who live in Israel have a very fine standard of living. Those who are living in all of the 21 or 22 other countries, Egypt, what, there are 56, 57 million Egyptians, I don't know, 80% of them are living below the poverty line. I mean, we're talking about the rulers who are concerned about the well-being of their people. They're not concerned about the well-being. I mean, huh? But you don't have to be a Saddam. That's the mistake we're making. You don't have to be a Saddam. You can be a Mubarak, and it's a Khurban over there. Cairo is most probably one of the most crowded cities in the world with the filth, absolute filth. So it says that an intelligent human being has to be able to rule over all of the organs of his body and all of his senses. He does not allow any of these limbs or faculties to go beyond their special task or encroach upon another. If you're going to use one part of the body, overuse it. You understand? You're going to lose, in a sense, the ability to use that part of the body well. You're going to have to recover from it all. You can't do anything to excess. The moment you do something to excess, you're in trouble. I did stretching exercises about 2 months ago after I wasn't feeling well for about a month. I had the flu. So after the flu, I had to get back to doing exercise. So I was a little bit too much in a hurry. You understand? Don't ask. My knees, my joints, very, very, very. And it was all because it wasn't done with a proper measure. You have to know what every organ of the body requires. He does not allow any of these limbs or faculties to go beyond their special task or encroach upon another. if he then has satisfied each of them, giving to the vital organs the necessary amount of rest and sleep, and to the physical ones, you have to have waking, movements, and worldly occupation. Here he's talking about exercise. You have to have a certain amount of movement. Without that movement, you're going to atrophy. You have to move. A man needs a worldly occupation. How do you like that? This doesn't sound from at all what the what he's saying. You need a worldly occupation. He's going to say later that to be able to provide nicely for your family is a holy thing to do. How do you like that? I have to cut that out of the kuzri. So you see, he becomes like a ruler. He has this whole army, all of his faculties, all of the organs of his body. He has to be concerned about all of them. And therefore, he calls upon his community as a respected prince calls his disciplined army to assist him in reaching the higher or divine degree, which is to be found above the degree of the intellect. You know, if the body is working and the mind is working and everything's trained and everything is kept within bounds, then all of this together, the entire makeup of the individual, can assist him in growing in terms of his relationship with God. He arranges his community in the same manner as Moses arranged his people around Mount Sinai. He orders his willpower to receive every command issued by him obediently and carry it out forthwith. He makes faculties and limbs do his bidding without contradiction, forbids them evil inclinations of mind. He is able to control his mind. He forbids them evil inclinations of mind and fancy. He forbids them to listen to or believe in them until he has taken counsel with the intellect. Before he permits himself to believe something or listen to something or assume something, he is going to weigh and measure it with his mind. If he permits, they can obey him, but not otherwise. In this way, his willpower receives its orders from him, carrying them out accordingly. He directs the organs of thought and imagination, relieving them of all worldly ideas mentioned above, charges his imagination to produce with the assistance of memory the most splendid pictures possible in order to resemble the divine things sought after. In other words, he begins to train his mind to look at the beauty and the good, and to remove from his mind the ugly. And the kind of pictures that he paints upon his mind are the scenes of Sinai, Abraham and Isaac on Moriah, the tabernacle of Moses, the temple service, the presence of God in the temple, and the like. He then orders his memory to retain all these and not to forget them. Those are part of the mitzvahs of Torah. There are things we have to remember. Zeichel Yitzias Mitzrayim. Remember what God did to Miriam. Remember also what Amalek did to you when you went down. That's training the mind, training the memory. There are pictures that the mind takes pictures. Digitally. You understand? There it is. You have the picture. And you can bring it back to mind all the time. He warns his fancy and its sinful prompters not to confuse the truth or to trouble it by doubts. He warns his irascibility and greed not to influence or lead astray, nor to take hold of his will, nor subdue it with wrath and lust. By the way, when you read it, you think like this is a very big job, but you should know most of us have succeeded in doing a great deal of this. We've done precisely that. I assume that we're all good, upstanding citizens. We're not Wildebrees. We are people who have trained ourselves. We are people who have a sense of balance. Are we? Am I right? Yes. Of course. We've done a pretty good job, Rega. As soon as harmony is restored, his willpower stimulates all his organs to obey it with alertness, pleasure, and joy. They stand without fatigue when occasion demands. They bow down when he bids them to do so and sit at the proper moment. The eyes look as a servant looks at his master. The hands drop their play and do not meet. Their feet stand straight, and all limbs are as frightened and anxious to obey their master, paying no heed to pain or injury. We do all sorts of things. Right, you think it doesn't take a lot of willpower to go through a Yom Kippur or to go through a long davening on a Yontif, and you know, there are a lot of things that we do that require of us a real degree of obedience. The tongue agrees with the thought. That's most probably one of the most difficult things, that we should be able to control what we say.
Would you say that of all the positive things which we should do, one of the most difficult is to give a warning to someone else? One needs a special personality.
One has to be very, very careful, because the Gemara says, just like it's a mitzvah to say something that will be listened to, so it is a mitzvah not to say something which we know somebody is not going to listen to us. But there are times one has to weigh and measure this. There are times that you'll be doing somebody a great kindness by saying that, listen, what you're doing is wrong, you should reconsider. But it's very difficult for us. You know, we like to be liked. And one thing is for sure, you're not going to win friends and influence people by telling them that they're doing something wrong. That's the way it is. But the halacha is very clear. That can't be a consideration. That's what makes the mitzvah difficult. That can't be a consideration. Because he may not like you, and so what? So what? Yeah, I say it so easily. It's my job to be the professional mochiach, so you know, so I have to find all sorts of ways, making believe I'm talking about somebody else, and I mean all these guys sitting right in front of me, right over here, you and you and you, but I leave them with the impression that I mean some fictitious figure out there who talks in the middle of davening. You understand, God? No, nobody here talks in the middle of davening. Yes. Yes.
And basically, what are the instincts and instinctive emotions like overpower most of the time in the how would you have a baby reacted in Clinton Lewinsky?
In what?
Clinton Lewinsky.
Well, first of all, let's say the following. I would say that that's a problem that you Americans have to deal with. We have to deal with a different kind of problem over here, and he's going to elaborate on how that's going to be the most important thing. How do you do this training? This is going to be very important. And ultimately, he's going to arrive at the conclusion. He's going to make it very clear. The whole gamut of mitzvahs, each one assists us in building up our character. The mitzvahs are calculated to do precisely that. I'll just give you 1 minute, and we'll elaborate on it. For the last 150 years, there was sort of the idea of the Musa movement. The Musa movement in yeshivas was that you have to work on your character. You can't simply assume that by keeping Torah and mitzvahs, your character is going to change. Now, there were those who disagreed with this. The Chazon Ish said, the greatest character building is just doing mitzvahs. Just follow the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is the book of character building. That's what it is. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to be going along with that kind of an idea. And he's going to demonstrate the impact that so many mitzvahs have upon us. That's going to be that which trains and edifies and prepares us for everything that we're supposed to be. To be continued. Chag Sameach, everybody.